Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. My guest is Heather Morris, whose international best-selling novel, The Tattooist of Auschwitz, is available in paperback. There are all sorts of books out there about the horrors of the Holocaust, but honest to God, I have never read anything quite like this, or even close to this. Heather, Slovakian Jew Lael Sokolov was a prisoner at Auschwitz, but he became a tattooist, essentially working for the SS. How did it come about that a prisoner became part of the machinery running that camp?
But the reality is that the SS had the prisoners, particularly the Jewish prisoners, doing all their dirty work. So Lally was just one of thousands, from pushing the people into the gas chambers, from taking the bodies out and throwing them into the crematoria, all carried out by prisoners.
So they're really working at the behest of the SS, but it's under a threat of violence, or how did they actually get them to do the work?
Well, absolutely threat of violence. Quite simple, if you didn't want to do the job, well, there was a gas chamber or a bullet, take your choice, and somebody else would do it. So that's how I maintained control, and whenever you got too weak or you were not doing your job properly, then you were disposable. And that particularly happened to the men who were working, putting the bodies into the ovens. I mean, this is such a horrible thing to talk about. But whenever they got too weak and were too slow, then they were just replaced. And in fact, they were replaced all the time because it was such a terrible thing that they were expected to do.
The tattooing that you talked about, this act of dehumanization, of putting numbers on somebody's body, how would that physically occur on these people?
You have to know, too, up front, I didn't appreciate this, but marking the skin by tattooing or any other marking for Jewish people, apparently, is a sin. So this is a real double whammy for them. Now, for Lally, he had these little blocks with numbers. They had pins. He called them pins. They were crossed between a needle and a nail. And they formed the number, all the different numbers, 0 to 9. And it was a matter of holding that over the person's arm, smacking it down to puncture the skin, running the rest of the numbers alongside, and then rubbing and forcing green ink into it. And that's the practical part of what he was doing. And all he could do, and he told me, and I had clarification of this a few months ago, that whenever he was particularly tattooing the girls, all he could do was say, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry I'm hurting you."
So as they're tattooing, the purpose of it was to put numbers on all of them, but how did the whole idea work that people needed numbers? Were they doing head counts, or, I mean, they were in a camp, they couldn't escape, so what was the purpose of the numbers in the first place?
Oh, dehumanizing, totally. Take away your name, take away your home, take away your family. Well, what's left? Okay, yeah, reduce you down to a number. But because they were keeping such immaculate files of everybody too, they could reduce all that detail of name, family, country, occupation, into a volume, into a book, give that person a number, and then all they had to do each day was go through the rolls of numbers for each block. So the real reason behind it was just dehumanizing.
Lael ends up meeting the love of his life. How did this meeting occur?
These had been in Auschwitz number one camp. There's two camps. They're 4 kilometers apart. And she initially had been in Auschwitz number one and was transferred as Birkenau was being built, and Lally was part of that first team of boys, young but healthy men, to build this horrible, horrible death camp, which when you stand in the front of it, you can't see where it begins and ends. The back or the sides, it's that vast. And Deesa and girls got moved over to Birkenau. When they had come in, they'd been tattooed or stamped. They had a different method than of stamping. And he was asked to go, and some of the girls, their numbers were fading. He was asked to go and redo them. And there he was, this 26-year-old man, this playboy, just love him and leave him kind of guy. For him, always being the necklace and girlfriend lining up back home, but him to then hold the arm of an 18-year-old girl dressed in rags and her head shaven and unbathed and say to me 60 years later, I knew in that second I would never love another. And he squeezed her arm and she looked into his eyes. And that was it. He was gone.
So how were they able to court each other in such a clandestine manner while they're both prisoners at this camp?
For the most part, they used as prisoners. There were tens of thousands of them in the camp. And when they weren't working on that odd day, being our men where they weren't working, usually a Sunday, they could just mingle in amongst them. Lally was allowed to be able to be wherever the girls were. Because of his role as the tattooist, the tattooera, he had freedom of movement. That was the biggest thing his role gave him, freedom of movement. Because he could be asked to go anywhere at any time to tattoo. And so he could be in the girls' area, and, the other girls would form a circle around him and Dita, and they could just spend a couple of hours walking together, getting to know each other, being protected by all Dita's friends.
When the camp was liberated, or at least before it was liberated, how close did the two of them come to death after they had met?
How close did they come to, sorry, to what, to death?
To death.
Any moment of any day, any week, your life was not yours to determine. Nutty, he pushed his luck several times and should not have survived. He had the luck of the Irish, I think you could say, or maybe just a cat with nine lives. He was a very manipulative man. He knew how to look for opportunities. And even when he got into trouble, he ended up being able to talk his way out of it. Dieter, of course, was taken on a death march a matter of days before the Red Army liberated the camp. Lally was taken out within hours of him arriving and sent to another camp, Mauthausen.
Now, the two of them, they ended up having this long love affair, marriage, all that. They're both deceased now. You were made it a point that you didn't actually interview Lael Sokolov, but rather you talked to him. So how did it come to pass that you were able to get this story from him?
Because I said yes to a friend who asked me to have a cup of coffee. I hadn't seen her for a long while. And while we were having a cup of coffee, she casually said to me, I have a friend whose mother has just died. And I didn't know where that was going. And then she said his father has asked him to find somebody he can tell a story to. And that person can't be Jewish. And she knew I wasn't Jewish. And she said to me, would you like to meet him? I don't know what he's got to say. And I said, yes, again. So being in the right place at the right time, having a cup of coffee with the right friend.
Well, why was it important that you were not Jewish?
Lally was very clear on that. He really asked me many questions the first time I met him, and I was embarrassed to have to admit that my knowledge, my small-town New Zealand education, had not given me very much about the Holocaust at all. And growing up, I never knew of anybody in the small place where I lived in New Zealand that was Jewish. But to him, telling this story to somebody who had no background, no family history, no baggage, he said, you will tell my story, you will not tell your family's story. And that was his reason. And many, many Jewish community groups and synagogues I've spoken to around the world, it's been quite lovely to have them comment to me during my talk and afterwards, Lally was a wise man. Lally knew what he was doing. So there has been no pushback to me by not being Jewish, quite the opposite.
How painful were those conversations that you had with him for you?
I'm sorry, sir, can you Can you repeat that?
I said, how painful for you were these conversations to have with Lael Sokolov to hear these horrors?
Oh, look, there's a syndrome called transference. When somebody sits and listens to somebody telling a particularly traumatic and tragic time in their life, but as that person does unburden and shed themselves of that history, it can actually fall on the person listening. And that did happen to me for a period. And it was my family had pointed out to me that I wasn't quite the same when I was coming home from being with him. And a colleague of mine who kind of smacked me around the head a bit and said, oh, for goodness sake, you have a classic case of transference. Get over it. And she was right. I had to find strategies and I had to tell myself that this was not my pain, this was not my guilt, this was not my trauma. I had no right to own it. And once I got my head around that, then it made my time back with Larry all the more beautiful.
All right, well, we've just scratched the surface of this beautiful novel, The Tattooist of Auschwitz by Heather Morris. The book it's an international bestseller, and it is now available in paperback in the United States, wherever your fine books are sold. Heather, this is just an amazing story that you've fictionalized for a novel here to tell it. Thank you for putting this out so we can all learn from it, and thanks for joining us today.
You are very welcome.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.